first, like to bring the Environment Natural Resources Policy and Finance Committee to order. We have a quorum. We have minutes of February 5th. Senator Parkleson, you want to move the minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the minutes of February 5th.
Thank you. Discussion of the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Minutes are adopted. This morning we'll start with Division of Fish and Wildlife. Director Bogus, welcome. I hope you're feeling better. If you could identify yourself and who's with you for the record. Our intention is to cover the last four divisions today, so if questions pop up, we'll take them and we'll try and move in an orderly and efficient manner. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, I'm Ed Bogus, Director of Fish and Wildlife for the Department of Natural Resources. I have with me Linda Kelly, our Administrative Services Section Chief for the Division of Fish and Wildlife. And our division manages a wildlife management area system in the state. It's about 1.3 million acres. We also manage about 930 miles or 45,000 acres of aquatic management areas. Aquatic management areas are a little less familiar to people, but if you think trout streams, that's the bulk of what the aquatic management areas are. We also have aquatic management areas on lakeshore and some critical ecological areas to protect sensitive lakeshore. We manage fisheries in 5,400 of Minnesota's 10,000 plus lakes that have fishable populations of fish, and also manage fishing in 16,000 miles of fishable streams and rivers in the state. There's over 60 wildlife game species and 28 sport fish game species that we manage. And the license center is also in our division, and that license center handles 2.4 million license sales transactions and 1.4 million registrations for boats and recreational vehicles each year. Our primary source of funding for our division is the Game and Fish Fund. This is a very important and foundational fund for our division. It consists primarily of revenue from hunting and fishing license fees. The other major source of revenue into this fund is from federal excise taxes on hunting and fishing equipment. And those federal excise taxes are apportioned back to the states by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service based on a formula of the area, geographic area of the state, and the number of certified license holders for hunting and fishing in the state. It's based on the number of individuals who have a license to fish or a license to hunt. There's some general fund that shows in our division budget. This is not operational money. This is an open appropriation out of the general fund for treaty settlement payments that show up in our division budget, but actually are not dollars that we access for any sort of management. There's various other sources of funds in the base budget as recommended by the governor, including some special revenue, some reinvest in Minnesota. That comes from primarily critical habitat plates, but also license plates for vehicles, but also from other previous appropriations that we've gotten. This governor's direct chart does not reflect dollars that are outside of our base that we get through Outdoor Heritage or Clean Water Fund.
Director Bogus, I have a question. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Bogus, on the number of the federal reimbursement, you said it was the number of licenses that are issued. I want to clarify, you know, because some cases we don't charge, so it's for a paid license or a license is issued.
Director Bogus.
Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian, yes, it is for paid license holders only, not for free licenses.
So,
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just then as a follow-up, can you get for us a breakdown on how many dollars we're missing out on federally as a result of having not paid for licenses, and how many licenses there are, and what areas they're in? Thank you.
Director Baucus, to that point, could you also, I know we've had this discussion before, do the feds allow us to charge a minimal fee, and then would we be able to capture that revenue? I don't know if you know the answer to that, but if you could incorporate that into that would be good.
Okay.
Director Baucus.
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, we can get those numbers, but it's just to make it clear quickly is that, yes, you can charge a minimal fee. You have to net at least a dollar for a license to be able to count as a sold license rather than a free license. And we have issuing charges through ELS and so forth, so it means the license has to be at least $3 in Minnesota to count as a license. So the youth licenses that are $5 do count. And also, Minnesota, to date, has been able to capture its full apportionment with our existing expenditures. We have to spend the money first and then get reimbursed. But so we haven't actually turned any federal dollars back. So just to clarify on the question that Representative Fabian was asking, but we can certainly summarize the number of free licenses where they actually have to have a license. There are some provisions where people can hunt or fish without a license.
Director Baucus, we maybe can clear it up here. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I think I heard you say that we have reached our cap. Are the federal funds capped? So, and where I'm going with this is if we're not missing out on funding, then it's probably not that big a deal, but it still would be nice to find out.
Okay. Director Baucus, I guess you do need to get us more information, but we will. Just if we know how close we're to that cap. Director Baucus.
Yes. We'll do that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Hanson, or did you have more, Director Baucus?
No.
Representative Hanson, to this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think maybe for committee and folks in the audience, the place where you're going on this is I see we are already having a bunch of bills introduced to exempt people at certain ages again and changing the age definition. And so when there's a free license, people don't have to buy a license, then we lose federal dollars unless we're capped. At that point, so all through the session, I'm sure we're going to see people exempting people with bills at certain ages or certain categories, but it does have a consequence on the budget unless we've already reached the cap that we're at.
Good point, Representative Dill.
Well, I think all of the things that have been said have answered your question. So we actually have, and maybe you'll give us this, we actually have a surplus of licenses to give free, without damaging the cap from the federal dollars. Is that what I heard you say? So in other words, if it takes 200,000 licenses to get all our money, but we sell 500,000, we in theory would have 300,000 that we could give away for free. Now, I know it damages the Game and Fish Fund. I'm just trying to get the way that works.
Director Baucus.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dill, I think we will get you the numbers on it because the apportionment is the amount that comes to the state of Minnesota, and that is based on land area, which we can't change, but also the number of certified license holders. So there actually is there is an overall cap of 5% of, you know, no state can get more than 5%, but we're at like 3.some%. So there actually is, back to I think Representative Fabian's original question, there actually is more federal money that we could leverage with more license holders in the state.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, well, we'll look for that information. Continue with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is just looking back at the current biennium at kind of how our money that we've been appropriated is spent by program area. We have five basic program areas kind of overall, and this is the outdoor recreation associated with hunting, fishing, and wildlife viewing. We're among the top states in the country for participation rates in hunting and fishing, and that's supported by the fish and wildlife populations and habitat, public hunting and fishing areas that we have in the state. So about three-fourths of our expenditures are for habitat and population management. Habitat management is about half. Population management includes things like surveys of populations, monitoring, managing seasons through regulation, research, and so forth. We also do technical assistance to other agencies and organizations. We conduct public participation to help make better decisions, do planning and coordination work with our partners. Also, outreach, recruitment, retention, and communication has been a bigger focus in our division in the last few years, where we're trying to do more to encourage outdoor recreation. It's a very healthy form of recreation. Unfortunately, we're seeing some of the younger age classes not participating in outdoor recreation at the same rate that some of the older cohorts have been. So we've been trying to come up with programs and work with partners on recruitment and retention. I'll talk about it a little bit more later. And then customer service includes our license center, sales, and you can see that all of those are smaller slices of the pie, the total program budget. In terms of the dedicated funds that make up the bulk of our budget, Game and Fish Fund, most of our expenditures are in the operations account. This supports our field staff and offices, fleet, so forth. There's some heritage enhancement, makes up about 10% of our Game and Fish. That's from lottery in lieu of sales tax dollars. They're deposited in an account, the Game and Fish Fund, called the Heritage Enhancement Account. There's a variety of dedicated accounts, all the stamp accounts for things like duck stamp, pheasant stamp, trout and salmon. Also, portions of the deer license are dedicated to different purposes, deer and bear management, computerized licensing, deer feeding and cervid health management, and wolf management. In the natural resource fund, we get a small amount of natural resource fund in our division. The biennial total is about $6 million. Most of that's water recreation. License center does all the boat titling and registration, also snowmobile and ATV. And we also do aquatic plant management, which means issuing permits for control of aquatic vegetation in public waters, partially using water recreation account money for that. We do have two initiatives in the governor's budget that I want to talk a little bit about. The first large one is for Fish and Wildlife Enhancement and Reinvestment. This has several components to it. One is for fisheries management and monitoring. We're second only to Alaska in terms of our per capita fishing. It's a very important economic driver, with the $2.4 billion in retail sales related to fishing in Minnesota each year, and we've really lost some of our capacity to do good fisheries management by being able to monitor fisheries populations and harvest through surveys and creel surveys of anglers. So this would add creel survey capacity, would help us to also enhance aquatic habitat, provide capacity to do additional survey work, especially on warm water rivers and streams, and would also allow for continued long-term monitoring of sentinel lakes. These are lakes that have been established across the state to monitor changes in those lakes due to changes in land use or climate or other factors that may affect those lakes. Another segment of this is, angler and hunter recruitment and retention. This is a portion of the initiative to help implement outcomes of the Commissioner's Council on Hunting and Angling Recruitment and Retention that was convened by Commissioner Landwehr a year and a half or so ago. And this would allow us to work with partners. DNR can't obviously deliver everything that would need to be done to help encourage youth participation. We have a lot of existing programs with partners like National Wild Turkey Federation, Pheasants Forever, Ducks Unlimited, Minnesota Waterfowl, and others. And this would build off of that, with the goal of conducting an Angler Hunter Recruitment Retention Academy that would help to facilitate the development and support of youth after school sporting club programs, angler hunter marketing campaigns targeted at adults. We're finding, as other states around the country, that maybe there needs to be more emphasis on young adults, because the programs for kids are good, but it's many years before they're able to take what they learn and be able to actually drive and purchase and get to where they can conduct those outdoor recreation activities. We deliver more learn to fish and hunt skills programs, provide family-oriented hunting and angling events, and create a web-based recruitment retention clearinghouse. Another component of this initiative relates to management of facilities. We've been getting more money to help manage habitat and maintain habitat through Outdoor Heritage Fund, primarily through the Lasard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council, but we really still don't have good funding for our facilities on wildlife management areas. There's a lot of site cleanup work that needs to be done, parking lots, road maintenance, and so forth, that we haven't had a good source of funding for, that this would help to catch up on some of that backlog. Would also allow completion of conservation easement baseline reports and ongoing monitoring of those easements, completion of plans for WMAs and AMAs and individual units and system planning, and then maintaining a wildlife and aquatic habitat management enterprise information system that we developed with previous Environment Natural Resources Trust Fund funding, but that is going to be going operational and needs ongoing.
Director Bogus, excuse me. I have a question. You talked about the additional work needs to be done on wildlife management areas. You talked about some of the work like road work and maybe parking lots and stuff like that, improving them for better hunting access and stuff like that. Is there a reason why can't that work be incorporated in restoration work that you do on WMAs as a Lasard Sams Outdoor Heritage Project? That seems like that. Those kind of, you talk like that maybe you didn't think that they could be incorporated into the in restoration enhancement part of, I would think that that seems like that would fit, Director Bogus.
Mr. Chair, maybe it's the way we've been trying to package it, but our understanding is that those things that relate to access and facilities are not habitat specific enough to qualify for the Outdoor Heritage funding, so it would be something we'd be interested in having more discussion about if, in fact, it would.
Well, I would encourage you to meet with Assistant Director Coop or Director Johnson and have discussions about. I myself have had a few experiences. Actually, the one I'm thinking of is in South Dakota, so it's not your fault. But the access could be improved in that instant where the hunters were really going on and off the highway, and where it could be improved. I certainly think that fits with enhancing, and myself, I believe that I'd really like to see it come with a really strong proposal next year with Lasard Sams to convert some of the existing brome grass and such into a higher, better prairie grass. Well, continue, Director Bogus. I'm sorry, Director Bogus, I did have one other one, as long as I interrupted you. Are you going to touch on the inequity between fish and hunting and the fee structure in the collection there? And I'm wondering, does Pittman Robinson allow you the flexibility? Can you fix that with Pittman Robinson?
Mr. Chair, I was not intending to do that, but I could do it real quickly since you asked. There is an imbalance. We do an annual Game and Fish Fund report that's required by law, and in the back of that report every year we report on this, what we refer to as an imbalance between the amount of revenue coming from fishing and hunting and the amount of expenditures for fisheries and wildlife. And for the past 10 years or so, there's been a higher proportion of revenue. In fact, over 100% of fisheries revenue is what the fisheries expenditures are, and about 92 to 95% of what wildlife revenue or hunting revenues are what the wildlife expenditures are. And so we've been committed to trying to close that gap to get them closer together. You're not necessarily shooting for 100% always, because you're kind of going through cycles of fee increases and things like that. But so there, the and then specific to Pittman Robertson, maybe just quickly on federal aid, the federal excise taxes on hunting and fishing equipment, the fisheries equipment, federal aid is usually referred to as Dingell-Johnson. That was the act in 1950 that established that. Pittman Robertson was actually in 1937 established the wildlife restoration function, and those are specific. The Dingell-Johnson is specific to fisheries projects. The Pittman Robertson is specific to wildlife projects, and committee should be aware that, and I know a number of you already are, that in the last several years there's been a huge increase in sales of firearms and ammunition that has generated many millions of dollars additional federal excise taxes that have been apportioned back to the state. Minnesota has seen on our Pittman Robertson apportionment, a few years ago it was around $11 or $12 million for Pittman Robertson. 2 years ago it was up to 16. Last year it was up to 23. And this current federal fiscal year that we're in right now, it's expected to be even higher than that. So that is challenging our ability to spend enough money to get the reimbursements back in, which is part of what is driving the wildlife side of this initiative. And by increasing wildlife expenditures, we can actually reduce this imbalance between hunting and fishing. So we are, in this initiative, proposing much higher expenditures for the wildlife side of the division than we are for the fishery side of the division. And primarily that's due to two things, the imbalance and the influx of Pittman-Robertson dollars through federal excise taxes.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Director Bogus, maybe you mentioned this, but how long will the Game and Fish Fund stay in the black? I mean, what's the reserve, and when do you anticipate it with projected spending to run into a shortfall again?
Director Bogus.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, the Game and Fish Fund right now is healthy due to two factors: the fee increase that this body passed in 2012 that took effect in March of 2013, and then the increase in federal excise tax dollars that are getting deposited in the Game and Fish Funds. The current balance in the fund is over $20 million, I believe. At current expenditures, it's not projected to go negative, but with all of the governor's recs that are in the various initiatives before you, it would be solvent through fiscal year 2019.
Continue, Director Bogus.
Okay, just quickly on this initiative, there's also another wildlife population habitat management and monitoring to enhance implementation of the prairie plan. This is a plan to try to improve the amount of grassland habitat in the agricultural parts of the state. That's one of the native prairie is one of the most endangered habitats in the state. This would protect not only native prairie but reestablish native grasses and forbs on lands, trying to connect corridors and core areas through enhanced local technical teams. These are teams that work with all the various federal, state, and local government partners and the non-governmental organizations to deliver prairie conservation. Would also include a forest and brushland habitat component for moose, grouse, fisher, pine marten, and other forest wildlife. Enhanced population data and analysis, research on various wildlife species, including contaminant effects on upland birds, prairie chickens, spruce and sharp-tail grouse, waterfowl, pheasants, fur bears, bear, wolf, squirrel, etc. And then annual surveys for wolf, moose, and deer would get some enhancement. We have gone to an annual wolf population survey that's been not quite the full-blown every 5-year survey. We also would like to refine our moose survey methodology. Moose have been in long-term decline in the last decade, and there would be some one-time expenditures for refining the moose survey methodology. And it would also allow us to recalibrate our deer models more frequently. And finally, it would improve customer information and services and technical assistance to our partners. We have another initiative on expanding shooting ranges. Legislature appropriated $2.16 million last year for expanded trap shooting ranges. We would like to build on that with a $500,000 a year proposal to enhance shooting facilities for archery and other types of shooting, particularly unstaffed ranges in areas that would allow people to sight in or shoot, also archery ranges would be a major focus of this. There's a huge interest in archery. There's lots of movies featuring archery right now. A lot of interest. We have there's a National Archery in the Schools program that Minnesota participates in that's in nearly 400 Minnesota schools right now and has about 180,000 students annually shooting archery in the school system. And we need more shooting range opportunities or shooting facility opportunities, archery parks and so forth, for people to get out and do archery. And we believe it'll lead to interest in other shooting sports as well, plus just the other types of shooting, rifle and other shooting beyond the trap shooting that we've got the grant program running for right now. And all of these initiatives would leverage federal apportionments of the Pittman-Robertson dollars that we talked about earlier, would increase recruitment and retention in not only the shooting sports but hunting in the state. So those are our initiatives, Mr. Chair and members. I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Representative Dill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I just want to confirm, I think I know the answer, that all of the money that we're spending on the enhancing shooting ranges, regardless of what it is in the future, none of that is general fund. That's all funds from Game and Fish, Pittman Robertson, all of those types of things. That's my first question.
Director Bogus.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, that's correct.
Representative Dill.
Thank you. And the next thing I was wondering, it would seem rather obvious that if we have X number of hunters or anglers in the state, but yet we have this big up and climbing number of people getting involved in, as you said, shooting sports, firearm shooting sports, archery and things like that. Is the department able to, other than just look and say, oh, well, our licenses are going up, or you have some way that you're going to judge the effectiveness of these programs that you just discussed versus license sales? I'm concerned that we get an upswing in license because the general populace gets more interested in hunting and fishing, but yet we don't have a way to index what it looks like that's coming from these young people that are involved in the trap shooting high school league or the archery league, the 180,000 people. We really don't have a way to evaluate that. I'm worried about that because I think that's really important information as we go forward trying to figure out what kind of resources to put in these programs.
Director Bogus.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dell, it's a really good question, and we've been struggling with how to document, what happens. The ideal way would be what we call a longitudinal study where you identify these people and you follow them through time and see what do they do next and how does that compare to the general population and so forth. We really don't have those kinds of studies right now, so the only way really to get at it is more indirect through, we can monitor license sales, we can monitor license sales by age, but it really still doesn't answer the question of where did they come from and why did they decide to do it. So we could do, more surveys of people that are purchasing those licenses to find out did they participate in a shooting sports, high school league, what got them interested and so forth. But we share your concern about wanting to be able to track that and not having a real good way to track it.
Follow-up, Representative Dill.
Well, thank you. And it was just suggested to me, and I'm not rather endorsing this or not endorsing it, but that when a person is involved in a sanctioned sport, as an example, let's use trap shooting because of the high school league, is a letterable sport, like basketball or football, that the first hunt, we encourage those folks to purchase a hunting license, and that we give them a price that really encourages them to hunt so that they get into the system, which then you can flag it as a person that was involved in the Minnesota High School Athletic Trap Shooting Team, and you have that in your computer, and then you can look at future license sales that are at the regular price into the future. You kind of see what I mean? In other words, like getting a loyalty card, so to speak, out of the chute because you're a part of this program. I don't know if that's anything that you could build from or look at, but some way to start tracking. I don't have the answer, but that just was something that was suggested. I mean, give a kid a hunt. No, don't give it to them, but I mean, you know, encourage them by getting them a hunting license. And then you've got them. You've got the information. You've got all the stuff in the state database. And then you can see if they buy them into the future and start doing that over a period of years, and you can start to build a case for or against expending money into these programs. And that's all I had, Mr. Chairman.
Well, good point, Representative Dill, that, and we did make big steps forward in that, in the $5 fee for all the different hunting opportunities for the kids that are getting in the sport to encourage them. Director Bogus, thank you for coming forward. Next, we'll have enforcement. Director Smith, if you could come down. Welcome, Lieutenant Colonel, if you could identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Rodman Smith, Assistant Director for DNR Enforcement.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colonel Sorian sends his regrets he couldn't be here today, so...
You're better looking.
Stuck with
go ahead.
The D-team, so. Just to frame real quick...
I didn't really say that.
Just to frame really quick, what the Division of Enforcement does is we're a service delivery division within the department, so our budgeting and how we use our dollars really go to two aspects, and that is salary and compensation, and then expenses used to support those people in the field. So we don't build bridges, we don't maintain trails. It's basically just service delivery and hours of service that we give to the various funds. So currently we employ about 185 conservation officers. We do have some vacancies. That number is 211 at full strength, and I can talk about that a little bit more at a change item. Annually, we certify about 36,000 students, and those are mostly youth, and majority of those are through the firearm safety programs. We also have snowmobile safety, ATV safety, and boating safety, but the majority of the students that come through are the firearm safety students. We also tracked here a few years ago just how many contacts, how many public engagements our officers have, and we have averaged about 1,300 distinct opportunities where officers met in front of groups of people. And these don't include our firearm safety classes. These are our officers going out, speaking at the Rotary, speaking at Sportsman's Club and whatnot. So we do a lot of outreach. We administered about 300 state and federal grants to local law enforcement and other user groups. Some of these grants would be snowmobile safety grants to sheriff's offices, boating safety grants to sheriff's offices. We also have a very good trail ambassador program for ATV where we do some grants with local clubs that help us patrol and maintain and kind of monitor some of our ATV trails in the state of Minnesota. It's really a progressive program that many of the other states are starting to adopt and look at adopting, so we're kind of on the forefront there with that group. Our budget is fairly straightforward, and it kind of models our work plan. 54% of our budget comes from the Game and Fish Fund. The next biggest would be the Natural Resources Fund, and there'll be a slide next that'll kind of show that breakdown from the different accounts. We do have 9% is from the general fund, and of that, about half of those dollars are earmarked for aquatic invasive species enforcement. So half of that general fund has that rider language for aquatic invasive species enforcement. And then we do have some special revenue on the side, and that's some of our aviation revolving account and whatnot. And then we just get a little bit of federal funding. We do get some federal funding from the Coast Guard for boating safety. The Game and Fish Fund, you can see the breakdown here. About 93% of it is from the Game and Fish Fund operations. We do get some heritage enhancement money. And then we get a little sliver that's technically not Game and Fish money, but there's something called the KT surcharge. So every citation that's written in the state, there's a small percentage that goes into a training fund for conservation officers. And that fund just happens to be... or that account just happens to be held in the Game and Fish Fund, so it's not really Game and Fish dollars, it's just dollars that are housed in the Game and Fish Fund. The Natural Resource Fund, our other biggest piece of funding, you can see the different accounts that come from there. We do have the Water Rec account, where we get some money through the Natural Resource Fund, the snowmobile account, ATV. Then the other would be the off-highway motorcycle account, off-road vehicle account, and that's pretty much the balance of our natural resource funding. So when we do our work plans for our officers on how many hours they work, we pretty much proportion their time related directly to the percentage of funding that we receive overall, and that guides our officers' work throughout the year. Do have three change items this fiscal year, and I'll run through these and then stand for questions. The first one is a investment in natural resource law enforcement. I mentioned earlier that we are at about 185 conservation officers today. We do have a number of vacancies throughout the state. Currently, as you're probably well aware, we have a deficiency bill that moved through Ways and Means yesterday. We are short. We have been living off our vacancies. We have had these increases in our operating expenses, everywhere from the pattern bargaining 3-3 that all state employees got, some increase in the employer portion of retirement, fleet costs, just all of our expenses go up, and we haven't been able to keep up with that through appropriations, so we've actually been living off vacancies in order to pay the bills. And so we're at a point now where I think I do have a map here. There's a map here that I'll hand out that might bring this home a little bit more. It's a map of our vacancies, and you can see in the red kind of where those vacancies are scattered throughout the state. So this change item would allow us to refill. These aren't new hires. This is just refilling the vacancies that we currently have, about 11 conservation officers, to try move forward to getting back to full complement for the serving the citizens of the state of Minnesota. So second change item we have is, I alluded to a little bit, part of it was part of the deficiency bill.
Director Smith, yes. Excuse me, I'm going to go back to the last one. You noted that you're refilling 11 of the vacancies, but we did, I know that you have overtime that you your officers use. Why would we not be filling all 24 vacancies to minimize the overtime?
Mr. Chair, the overtime issue is something that we needed even at full strength. We don't, even at full strength, 211 conservation officers, there's not enough of us to do the job in the field, and we needed to have overtime to be able to answer calls of service. We've had the same number of conservation officers in the field since the 1940s. If you look at the number of sales, license sales, and the number of people engaging in hunting, and the broadening of the responsibilities conservation officers have now since then with wetlands enforcement, groundwater enforcement, aquatic invasive species, we needed to be able to be responsive to all the calls. So even at full strength, that overtime is something that's needed to deliver service to the people.
And Director Smith, why are you not asking to go to full complement?
Mr. Chair.
Is that a question for the governor?
Thank you.
Okay. Additional questions. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify, Director Smith, did you say that you have the same number of enforcement officers today that you did in 1940?
Director Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, just to be clear, the same number of officers in the field delivering service. We've had some very small movement over the time. We've had some special initiatives. We had a group of legislators that wanted to have an officer in the headwaters of Mississippi area, so a couple years back we were given an appropriation and created a position there. Back in the, I believe it was the late 90s, we had a lot of issues with ATVs and youth with ATVs, so we worked with stakeholder groups and legislators, and we did to get some additional funding to have a couple rec specialists to concentrate on educating youth, and it was fantastic. You don't see the activity in the road ditches like you used to, so we had two positions there, but overall, The station boundaries that you see here have been the same with the same number of officers probably since the 1940s.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to get an idea about the work. I know this poaching ring that recently was exposed in western Minnesota. I think I remember reading that it took 2 or 3 years to uncover that. Did you have anything like that? I mean, is this a relatively recent thing where you're seeing these organized efforts on poaching for trophy animals that require a lot of research and detective work? I mean, did we have that in the 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s, 80s? I mean, is it just a recent thing? And maybe talking about the workload and how the job has to adapt to that type of law breaking.
Mr. Director Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I can't speak to the 30s and 40s or even the 70s or 80s, but today those investigations are more and more common. And it is common in natural resource or conservation law enforcement, not just in Minnesota, but nationwide, that people that do nefarious things with our natural resources, they do it every year until they get caught. It does take time, a lot of times, to catch these folks to get what we need. So a lot of these investigations take multiple years to complete. They are getting more difficult, and they are more time intensive with social media and the technology that people have today. It is a little tougher to make these cases, so we do have officers spending time on these, and they're important. They're very important because, you know, we don't have the luxury of traditional law enforcement where a field officer can get a case and then send it off to an investigator who's then going to, or a detective that's going to do it. Our officers in those stations are the beat cop and the detective all in one. So it does pull their time when they have these investigations, and then they have to answer calls of service to the public. So it does take time, and it is getting tougher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in terms of statutes or law, so a case like that where you've got game and fish violations, the violations in themselves, do you have any statutory enforcement tools relating to conspiracy? Or relating to different than someone breaking law, but organized efforts relating to the illegal taking and selling or trying to get the trophies. Do you have the penalty authority or the statutory authority needed to really deal with those?
Director Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, we do have joint and several liability in game and fish law, and so I think that we have what we need, yes. Thank you.
Representative Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and welcome. I see you again.
Yes.
See, I'm just looking at your map, the one with the vacancies.
Yes.
And I counted very quickly, I'm going to draw a line about halfway across the street, east and west. And I think you can imagine here where I'm talking about. I counted 18 vacancies south, and I counted 5 in the north, right along the Canadian border. 4 of which, I wonder if they have to do with Fabian, but that's just a question I have. Anyway, why is that? Representative Fabian.
To that point, no, man.
Representative Deal.
My question is, why is it so prevalent to have all the vacancies in the south and very few in the north, even though there's one right by my house, I think.
Director Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, that changes over time. If you would have looked at this map a year ago, those red spots would have been flipped. There would have been more vacancies. We just added an academy of 10 people, and we had 4 of them go to the Baudette area, the various, and so this is constantly changing. It's constantly moving because of retirements and people moving. We do see a little bit of a change. It is difficult sometimes to get officers to station in some more traditionally rural areas because the times have changed a little bit. They have, you know, two income households now, and a lot of our officers, in the old days, they used to be the major breadwinner. Now spouses have masters and PhDs, and they need to go to a place where both people have the opportunity for employment. So we do have a little bit of difficulty sometimes filling some of these more rural areas.
Thank you.
Thank you. Continue, Director.
The second change item we had was somewhat related to the deficiency bill that was there, but we do want to have a long-term fix, and we're asking for, and this has been kind of put together because we weren't sure of the deficiency bill, but the second change item is going to be a long-term funding solution for the retirement increases that we are realizing as the employer-paid portion that is required of us now with the changes in that MSRS had passed about 2 years ago.
Director Smith, if I can ask, did you say this number will be adjusted if the deficiency bill passes, or it is reflective, assuming the deficiency bill is fully funded?
Mr. Chair, this will change.
Thank you. Continue.
The third change item,
Representative Dill.
So thank you. I want to go back to the deficiency that I put up the slide, but when I heard the explanation of the reason for the deficiency bill addition for enforcement, it almost felt like it's an open appropriation now, like fire, like what you're getting ready to talk about, I think. And I'm just wondering how it is that you can overrun your budget by $500,000 or whatever that number was. Is it because you feel that the enforcement is required? Is it the fact that the officers are out doing different things, ATV, snowmobile, fisheries, and just billing the account, and it's not closely enough managed? And if we don't fund the previous slide in the coming biennium, does that mean we should expect more and more deficiencies, especially as you add in more, fill more vacancies, because your cost is going to go up, but your funding remains level, and we're going to get bigger and bigger requests for deficiencies, which essentially creates an open appropriation? Did you understand that?
Director Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think I did. So we went into the last fiscal year knowing we had a $1.8 million deficit. And because what we have, how we are funded and what we do, there's really very few places we can cut because it's compensation and fleet and other things that support the officers in the field. And so we tightened our belts. We did a lot of things to get that $1.8 million number down to 1.3, and we needed this last $568,000, the deficiency bill, just to keep us in the black. Moving forward, if we don't get some of this help, we will not be filling vacancies, and we'll continue to live off those vacancies to fund where we have. The expenses, the increases in the expenses that we had are things that are pretty much out of the control of myself or Colonel Soaring, because they're expenses related that other people bring to us, like the fleet expense increase, the pattern bargaining for for all the employees to get for the raises that our Allstate employees got, this retirement issues and other expenses that go up. So those expenses aren't always calculated. Unfortunately, when a budget bills moving through the legislative session, some of those increases, like fleet, sometimes were not realized until right before the start of a fiscal year or biennium. So we do get kind of caught flat-footed. And in an organization like ours, where we don't have a lot of that extra money, it's hard for us to manage that.
Representative Dillon, any follow-up? Representative Fabian.
I'll pass. Thank you.
If you could, we'll have you walk through the rest of it, and then we'll save questions till the
end. My last slide. So the last thing last change item we have is we do have the aviation unit. The overwhelming majority of the flying that we do is not for enforcement. It's for wildlife, fisheries, eco waters, doing census surveys and whatnot. Back in the 90s, we were given actually four helicopters from the military. Two of them flew and two of them didn't. They were OH-58s. One of them was a 1968, one's a 1972. They'd have collector plates on them if they were automobiles. We're to the point now where we've used every part we can out of the two that don't run. The two that do run, we need to buy the blades are timing out, and you can't find them. You might as well just buy a brand new helicopter and try to replace the blades. So what we're looking at and what we're asking for is to get rid of the OH-58s that we got from the military surplus. And instead of buying two helicopters, replacing it with two, we're trying to right size, get down to one replacement helicopter, which will serve the customers' needs that we have at DNR where we do most of our flying.
Director Smith, can I ask you to work with Representative Dill so that he has a confidence in what you're doing in regards to this aviation is in the correct direction?
I'd be happy to, yes.
That's his background to this point. Representative Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Director Smith, so I see Representative Hausman just came in the room. And some years ago, we bonded for the two CL-215s, and now I understand that they have been or are going to be disposed of, and that you're leasing fire bosses, which I thought was a great idea when Commissioner Holston was here. And we actually went down to look at the manufacturing of the fire bosses. Good job. But I'm wondering, where did those bonding is, and I'm going to depend on Representative Hausman here, I believe that bonding has a 20-year life. I mean, a 20-year payback on that. But those assets will last 20 years, but they were disposed of. So where did the money go from the CL-215s, or where will it go that you got for them when you sold them? Did it go into this program for the purchase of a new helicopter, or did it go back to the State General Fund from where the money came from in the first place for the bond?
Ms. Julek will answer that. If you could identify yourself for the record, and I think you heard because I saw you nodding your head.
Mr. Chair, Barb Julek, Department of Natural Resources. The funding from the sale of the two CL-215s went back to the fund for the fire program. It's two separate aviation programs, so that money does not go to support this.
Representative Dill, I don't think that answered your question. You want to reframe it? Representative Dill, you might need to ask your question again.
I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the CL-215s were bonded for. And I recall a bonding bill passing for the two CL-215s for the purchase. It was not, am I incorrect, Representative
Dill? Representative Dill, why don't we get an answer to that? Representative Hackbarth, to this point.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think the money for the planes, the bomber planes, came out of the fighter account, not bonding.
Mm-hmm. Okay, is everybody on the same page? All right, we're moving ahead.
Yep. Okay, thank you.
Director Smith, you're done? Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry. Oh, I have Fabian on the list. Is this you, represent Fabian?
Thank you, Mr.
You're
Chair.
You're hiding behind Ms.
I am.
Bo.
Yes. If I can get the pages to work with me and hand this out. I have a question on enforcement on some OHV trails. The document that I have here...
Representative Fabian, yep. Maybe you can tell us what the document
is. I will. There's $243,000 charged in fiscal year 14, actual, on 30 miles of OHV trails. I'm just curious to know how we're charging against that OHV account so much in enforcement.
Director Smith, I'm going to let you take a deep breath here. Are you ready?
Yep.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I'm ready.
Go ahead, Director Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, the issue isn't the miles of trails. The issue are the operation of these vehicles outside of where they're legally allowed to operate. So in anticipation of this, I did ask our folks to look at the contacts that we've had with ORVs in the past 3 years. FY12, we wrote 13 tickets and 20 written warnings to ORVs across the state. FY13, 15 tickets, 13 warnings, 3 civil citations. Last year, FY14, we wrote 26 citations, 26 written warnings, and 2 civil citations. The issue isn't the operation on that small segment of trail. There are very few miles of trails for ORVs. It's those people that operate outside those trails that cause the problems and cause the phone calls to legislators and others. So that's where those dollars are spent.
Follow-up, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, to that point, I've never received a phone call to that issue. I'm just curious about this. This was brought to me, obviously, and I don't know if Representative Hackbarth has got anything planned in his committee, but thank you.
Additional comment? Thank you, Director Smith, for coming in. Next, we have Ecological Service and Water Resources, Director Luke Skinner. Director, if you could identify for yourself for the record, and then welcome and begin.
Mr. Chairman, good morning. My name is Luke Skinner. I am the Director for the Division of Ecological and Water Resources and Division in the DNR.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Division of Ecological Water Resources promotes and delivers integrated water and conservation, ensure healthy surface water, groundwater, and contributing lands. We provide critical information and regulatory oversight to foster natural resource stewardship and enhance recreational and economic uses. Our customers include local units and government, conservation organizations, businesses, landowners, and all of our citizens of the state. Here's a few quick facts on what we do. Some of the programs that we manage are County Biological Survey, County Geological Atlas, Dam Safety, Scientific and Natural Areas, Invasive Species Program, and Non-Game Wildlife. Our overall budget, you can see biannually, is right here, and it's heavy with dedicated accounts. The general fund is primarily for groundwater management and invasive species. What we do, you know, there's three kind of categories of work that we do overall in the division. And the first is inventory, monitoring, and analysis. We collect and deliver information on water, habitats, plants, and animals. And we ensure environmental information for maintaining high quality of life, safety, and is available for public, for state and local governments. The second is conservation assistance and regulation. And this is really ensuring recreation, habitat, and water quality are regulated. The purposes for safety and available for public use. We provide oversight for local units of government for shoreland, floodplains, and wild and scenic rivers. And we regulate the use of water provided for sustainable use. And the third category is ecosystem management and protection. The management and prevention of invasive species, which you're well aware of, the management of our scientific and natural areas across the state and our prairie bank program, and protection and threatened and endangered species in the state. These are a breakdown, a little bit of our dedicated funds. The Heritage Enhancement is a subset of the Game and Fish Fund is part of this, and this is used primarily for a variety of things, including our SNA programs, aquatic plant management, stream habitat protection, and wetland monitoring, and that goes for both those categories. The water management is mostly related to our 103G, which is water use permits, public water supply plans, water use data, and dam safety. And invasive species, as we'll be talking about in just a little bit. And the Water Rec also helps support those same types of work, including aquatic plant management, lake aeration systems, aquatic invertebrate work, and also lake and river improvement around environmental review. Our first change item that we have is on heritage enhancement and natural resources. And one of the big challenges we have right now is that the non-game program, the funds coming in, have declined over time, and so we have a loss of revenue from that, and with that comes a loss of match. A lot of these funds are matched federally and with other state dollars such as RIM dollars, and we're having some impacts there. So here we're asking for an increase to heritage enhancement to offset some of that, and also decrease the amount of money we're spending from the non-game program to stabilize that fund. One of the big issues here for us is the match, is that both the Minnesota County Biological Survey work, which is around a lot of our animal work in this particular case, has SWIG match, which is state wildlife grant match from the feds. And so if we don't have these dollars, we lose that match. So it's kind of a little bit of a double whammy. Also with our muscle restoration work in the Mississippi River and other endangered mussels, we get matching dollars from the Army Corps of Engineers. And then those dollars are lost as well. So we're asking for an increase in that fund to be able to maintain and manage those dollars and also manage the non-game account. Our second change item is on invasive species, and this is to increase dollars to help support the counties. work that's all been going on out there. Last year, the division received $400,000, one-time dollars, to help set up to support all the county work that's going on with their new dollars for implementing both management and prevention work across the state. And it's to maintain that work and also increase it by two other FTEs to help with the planning across the state for invasive species. The invasive species account does have a structural deficit, so some of these dollars would go back into the account to manage that while supplying additional dollars for work. The surcharge has not been increased since 1993, so it's been over 20 years since that time.
Director Skinner, so it's $5 per watercraft, and would that be the every third year that they renew?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. It's every 3 years.
And so that would be $5 times 800,000 registered watercraft divided by three would be the annual amount that you would be getting?
That is correct.
And approximately, what is that amount on an annual basis? Do you, does Ms. Jewlett know that number?
I have it.
You have it, okay.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. So revenues, Mr. Chairman, revenues expected by this change are right about $1 million. The expenditures that we're asking for is about 958, and actually that's in year one and year two. The revenues would be 1.3 million, and the remainder would stay into the fund to help the fund balance.
And remind me, Director Skinner, boat renewals, are they spread out throughout the year, or are they one time a year? Do we all get them at the same month, or how do they work?
Mr. Chairman, it depends when you register your boat. So they're split over the 3 years. Not everybody registers on the same year.
I was asking if they're only one time. Representative Hackbarth, do you know the answer to what I'm asking? Representative Hackbarth.
Mr. Chairman, the renewals are all up at the same time.
Okay. So they're once a year. And what time of the – so is that why it's less the first year you're caught in the timing? I'm wondering, do they all come – they do all come like in February or something, don't they?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. It's just that by the time that people actually register in that fiscal year, you only gain some of that revenue. You get full revenue from the second year of the biennium.
Okay. Sorry. Thank you, Director Skinner, for that. Can I go back to the one before that, rare resource preservation?
Mm-hmm.
That's match money you're concerned about losing. Where is the money? What are we approving here? You lost me in where this money actually, what fund is it coming from again?
We're asking for an increase to the heritage enhancement account from this. And this is to offset losses right now that we're seeing in the declines of revenue from the non-game account.
Thank you. Representative Hansen. I'm sorry. Well, Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Also, on the same page that you just questioned, the donations for non-game wildlife have decreased. How is that promoted or marketed? Or there's not any logical reason that should have decreased, right? Or is there an explanation? And do we need to do something to promote that?
Director Skinner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hausman. I'm not sure. We have a pretty aggressive campaign around the non-game program, trying to advertise it and that. And part of it is the chickadee checkoff, right? And so people are putting less into that. So part of it's our promotions. We still promote as heavily as we can on that. But we're seeing a decline overall in some of those receipts that we receive. So I can get more information on that. I don't know the exact detail why the decline, but that's the primary way is through the tax write-off.
Thank you. A follow-up, Representative Hausman?
No, it would be interesting to know. I mean, it's whether there's any explanation or are people overlooking it or.
Okay.
If you have more information, if you could get it to the committee, that would be great. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Skinner, on your invasive species page, you mentioned that the outcomes would be to prevent the introduction of new invasive species into Minnesota and prevent the spread of invasive species. Those are laudable goals, but what's our success record?
Director Skinner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Torkelson. Our program, as you know, is both based on education and enforcement and regulations. Our program helps prevent the spread, but not eliminate it, as we know right now. We've seen that last year, in the past couple years, if you look at overland spread, especially of zebra mussels, we see the zebra mussels spread within systems, but within individual lakes, we think we had five overland spreads of new lakes this year. So we're reducing the spread, but so far we have not, you're right, we have not completely eliminated it.
Follow-up, Representative Torkel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Skinner, is there anything we can do to focus our efforts to make them more effective? Have you given some thought to that?
Director Skinner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Torkelson. I'm just coming back into this, and I worked, as you know, I was the supervisor of the invasive species program for more than 6 years, stepped back, and I'm stepping back in, and I am looking to see how we evaluate how we're doing that work. We're certainly working with the counties, and now with the county dollars, and the works is really going to help build that, and we're trying to support that work. So not only the work that we do, but the work that the counties do will help drive that and help do more prevention efforts on the ground.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up, Representative Torres.
Just throwing more money at it, I don't think, is really the entire answer. We need to use those dollars effectively, and I'm not sure we're so good so far. Thank you.
Additional comment, Director Skinner? No? Okay, Representative Hackbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Director, could you tell me, is there a balance in the AIS account at this time?
Director Skinner.
Mr. Chairman, right now there is a balance, but it's projected to go negative in 17, this year 17.
Follow-up, Representative Hackbar.
Mr. Chairman, so there's a balance there now. Do you know what the balance is right now?
Mr. Chairman.
Director Skinner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hackbar, I do not.
Ms. Julek, do you have it? Thank you. If you could come forward. Identify yourself for the record again.
Mr. Chair, members, Barb Julek. Just need to find it. Mr. Chair, in the November forecast, the balance projected at the end of 16 is 95,000. Positive. At the end of 17, it's a negative 309,000.
Follow-up, Representative Hackbart.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The balance right now. Do we know the balance of
Ms. Dooley?
Mr. Chair, at the end of fiscal 14, it was $1.5 million. It is projected at the end of 15 to be 500,000.
Representative Hackbar.
Thank you.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Skinner, I do have two questions. Number one, given your background in aquatic invasive species, are you aware of any place across the U.S., and this is probably too broad a question, but if it isn't possible to get that information, then maybe just in Minnesota, are you aware of any case where we have been able to eradicate a species of AIS in an aquatic context? And then two, if going forward, are we considering other strategies to restore recreational value where we have had these kinds of problems?
Director Skinner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Heitzman, eradication has been very difficult across the country. I've worked on a number of species over time, and most of the actions have been around managing and reducing their impacts that they cause to the system. But we're trying to take some aggressive approaches around zebra mussels in certain situations, such as Christmas Lake. If you catch them in a certain position, at a certain level or in a certain small, you might be able to do that, and that's why we're trying to aggressively do that, look at those. But long-term, like zebra mussels, I think it's working with the University of Minnesota and their new research center to figure out ways that we can manage it, reduce their impact, and look for those management tools. So it's prevention, eradication where we can, and then long-term management of those species once we have them established in the system.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Skinner, so here it's a clarification then. Is that a no, that we have not eradicated an invasive species that you're aware of?
Director Skinner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Heitzman, in the state of Minnesota, we'll know soon if we did it in a single location, such as Christmas Lake, but on a landscape scale across the state, the answer is no.
To that point, though, Director Skinner, maybe we haven't eradicated the sea lamprey in the Lake Superior, but from decades ago, the way it is today has been a complete success. And if I'm not mistaken, that was a thank you to the University of Minnesota, and that's why so much focus, where we can't maybe completely eradicate, we maybe can get it down to where it's not devastating on the ecosystem. So, follow-up, Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Skinner. So I guess what I'm trying to do is trying to encourage in places like your agency We have a lot of water in my district. It's the it's central Minnesota, Brainerd Lakes area. And we've seen a number of cases where a species, and I brought this up in other committees, but a species like the narrowleaf cattail that hasn't necessarily been identified as an invasive species is having a negative impact in places where, for example, we've had a crappie spawning bed and people would fish there. There's no more, that entire bay might be choked out on a lake like Lake Edward. And I'm wondering if we're going to consider down the road where we have had plants and other animals that have done damage to these to the recreational value, can we look towards strategies to restore that? And in working with my watershed district and other associations, the permitting process was very complicated, and really the answer that we got back was it's too hard. And I'm wondering if we can move towards developing strategies to restore recreational value in those kinds of places.
Director Skinner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Heintzman, the answer overall, I think, is yes. That's one of our main goals, is to try to restore and maintain both economic, recreational, and natural resource use of our lakes and streams and rivers, and even our terrestrial. And each plant and animal is different, so we'll have to work on those individually and see the best way we can do that.
Follow up, Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Skinner, so are you telling me that in cases where you have a plant that has done a lot of damage, like the narrowleaf cattail, that dredging may be on the table?
Director Skinner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Heintzman, I'm not sure about that. We can talk about that further out. I don't know the specifics on this, so I'll have to wait and hear more.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Skinner. The answer that we are hearing across the agencies is no, and that's what I'm frustrated about. There has to be a strategy to restore that recreational value where it's been lost, and it's nice to say that that's a strategy and that it's important, but unless we're actually able to translate and put that directly into action, I would really appreciate that.
Thank you. Representative Hackbart.
I'll pass.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, this debate we've been having for many years, and prevention is cheaper than cleanup, because it's always the public that has to do the cleanup when it's the restoration. So to go back and to redo places and to restore them, it would have been much more cheaper and much effective to prevent that contamination by biological entities in the first place. This brings us back to the transport. So we start dealing with commerce, and then we can't deal with commerce. Nope, we don't want to impact anybody's movement of things. So, can't do any prevention because people get upset. And then we come to the public, come to all of our taxpayers to pay for the cleanup again and again and again. And we'll try to clean it up. We've seen this with milfoil, with all these things. Come back, doesn't take. Carp. Doesn't take. Come back, spend some more public money. So we have to deal with prevention, because we're a big state, and once these things get infested, it's very hard to clean them up, and very, very, very costly.
To that point, Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't think anybody here is arguing that we do not prevent the spread of AIS. I think what we're looking for is a strategy to repair. I've had a lot of conversations with folks at IDNR, and maybe they value their lakes in a different context than we do. They don't have as many. And they are doing restoration, and it is costly, I agree. But there are lots of cases where we could be looking at strategies to repair damage where it makes sense.
Well, and to that point also, I would say, I've got a couple of friends that own some lakeshore property in the Detroit Lakes area, and when the invasion of the narrowleaf cattail first came to their lake, they were very, very willing to do something at the very start of that invasion as a lake association and as lake property owners, but because of the policies that are in place within the agency, they couldn't touch those narrowleaf cattails, and I think that pretty much everybody agrees that that is an invasive and it's kind of an undesirable. And so then what happens, what Representative Heintzman is talking about, is you get a crappie spawning bed that becomes choked and it no longer produces the things that most of us like, And so then here we are, stuck with an even bigger bill as far as, you know, the restoration or the cleanup or whatever terms we want to use for that. And, you know, Director Skinner, I would encourage you and the agency to be more proactive at the very, very early stages of some of these things and allow for the local people who have a tremendous attachment to, I'll say, their lake, to be actively involved and willingly involved in this, you know, and let's try to take down some of the barriers so that we can attack these invasives in a more comprehensive way. And I also wanted to ask one question about potash treatments with regards to zebra mussels, and I think, if I'm correct, that is that the Christmas Lake thing that you're talking about?
Representative, yes, that is correct.
So do you have any preliminary findings on how that's going?
At this point, I still think they're waiting to do their next test. They did originally did a Zequinox treatment, then they expanded the area slightly, and then they did a potash treatment, and now we're still waiting for the final results. And some of that we'll have to wait probably till ice out. They can do some things through the ice, but ice out will probably be the time when we'll find out the final.
And so then what kind of coordination do you do with other states that have faced these same issues that Minnesota is currently and has been facing for a number of years? And are there strategies that work that you're incorporating that have worked in Wisconsin or Michigan or wherever?
Representative Fabian, members, we coordinate heavily both with the Great Lakes. We have Great Lakes Panel on Aquatic Nuisance Species and the Mississippi River Basin Panel and the Western Panel. We coordinate with them quite regularly. We have a lot of opportunities to talk and share ideas about how things are done. The potash treatment came from other areas of the country. It didn't start here, that they tried in some quarries and some other places that we're trying to test here. It's not an approved. We got an experimental use to do that, but it's not an approved method, but it's something we'll continue to work with others on.
Thank you. And for members who are interested in that potash treatment, you can just do a web search for that and type in Lake Winnipeg is one of the areas. I know that they did a very, very extensive effort up there to basically eradicate the zebra mussels with potash. So, thank you. Proceed.
Representative Fabian, members, I only have 2 slides left, and it's just a touch on the clean water legacy funding. This is because it's a 2-year cycle, it's also considered a change item. Here's a history of the spending and the categories of spending for that. We try to provide information that leads to strategic investment with multiple benefits, highlighting our hydrology as a major driver of our water quality impairments. And monitoring assessments a big part of that, watershed restoration protection strategies, drinking water protection, non-point source implementation, and applied research such as our geologic atlas and other tools to help drive that work. And for the clean water change item, it's those same things, improving and continuing on those same efforts that have already been done. The monitoring assessment work around lake IBI and load and biological monitoring. Watershed restoration is work on planning and protection strategies. Drinking water protection is really about evaluating groundwater monitoring in our network across the state. And our non-point source implementation is shoreland work, technical assistance, restoration, stream habitat work, stewardship plans. And then, of course, our research is around the county geological atlas and other resources to improve hydrogeology to help us with this work. And with that, that's it.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a question on the atlases, taking a look up at the graphic that you have up for us right now. I noticed that there's a number of areas that we don't have them underway. At the current funding rates, how long will it be before we complete the state?
Director Skinner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fisher, I'm not exactly sure on the total amount of time. I know the number of wells. I can get that information for you. I'll have to ask our hydrogeologist. That's one I'm not sure about.
Thank you. Follow up? No. Okay. Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Skinner. In our war on invasive species here, we are developing, you know, many more tools in the toolbox that I think are becoming more effective in everything else. But to Representative Heinzman's point, why do you feel that dredging in some cases is inappropriate? Because I've heard that from many watershed districts and people that that you frown on that, but yet it's an obvious situation where you could improve the habitat.
Director Skinner.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, from my experience, I do not have a lot of experience on dredging, and so I have a hard time answering that question. It does change the crossing core section of the lake, and there are some rules about that. The effectiveness long-term may not be there just by removing things like that. I'm more than willing to find out more information and bring it back if needed. But it has not been used as an effective tool to managing. It can reduce and deepen a lake, but necessarily won't get rid of an invasive species. With the propagules and the things all around in the lake, it eventually comes back.
Representative Hugel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Skinner. Well, yes, I think that it would take a multi-pronged approach, but some of these, when you do get the cattails in there and things like that, all the silt that comes in and the actual change of a body of water from something that is clean and clear and provides good fish habitat, you have the invasive species that come in. So from a remedial standpoint, it seems that this is a relatively simple tool that we could use in conjunction with perhaps, you know, some biologicals or chemicals. So I too am puzzled about that. Thank you.
Thank you. Additional questions? Thank you, Director Skinner. Appreciate you coming in. Welcome, Director Martinson. I think maybe Ms. Julek is going to come forward and you're going to tag team. Good to see you again. If you could identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Lori Martinson. I'm the Director of the Operations Services Division for the Department of Natural Resources. I'm here today to talk about Operations Support Program funding. Operations Support includes the Commissioner's Office, Regional Operations, my division, and the School Trust Manager position. So School Trust Program is also in there. In my division and for the agency overall, we're managing about $500 million in expenditures. We provide services to over 4,760 employees. We manage 2.9 million square feet of office space at 200 locations statewide. We manage 5,000 pieces of fleet equipment, 1,600 on-road vehicles, 1,700 off-road vehicles, and 1,700 trailers and attachments. We deposited over $60 million in the permanent school fund in fiscal years 12 and 13. The operating budget for 16-17 is broken out here for you. It's $168.7 million. Special revenue is some of the internal billings, and I can go into the next slide in some more detail on that. So in this area, you can see that fleet and facilities asset management is about $50.7 million for the biennium. Facility direct costs, that means leases, fuel and electricity and connectivity charges at co-located offices, runs us about $6.9 million. We have professional services. This includes engineering services, IT services, a whole host of range of services are provided out of the shop. And then IT services that are not professional services but are part of the consolidation effort that we manage the funding internally within my shop, and then pay Minute Central, $25.2 million on an annual basis. And then we have some other funds, which include FEMA, the Conservation Volunteer Magazine, Worker Comp, the Attorney General's Office. It's a whole host of things where we provide some financing within the agency so that it's an easier way to pay the bills. And then finally, Operations Support Shared Services. This includes leadership services, as well as HR, budget, finance and budget, the planning services, safety, and who am I forgetting? That's it. I'm quickly getting into our first change item, and maybe Robert Mackey, our CIO, may join me. If you have questions, get into the technology side. That is not my area of expertise. We have a change item here that's $1 million over the biennium, $500,000 annually to update our website. Our website was built by our staff, and in the, what year, Robert, was that? a couple decades ago.
In 97.
And so,
sir, if you could identify for yourself for the record.
Yes, my name is Robert Mackey. I'm the Chief Information Officer for the Department of Natural Resources, working for Minute Services.
Well, continue, so, Director Martinson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So our website needs to be updated. We need a new platform that will allow us to integrate the information and the services we have to provide better service for our customers. A modernized platform, we need to refresh our digital content. A lot of it's been up there since 1997, and so it needs some refreshing and some modernization. And we really are looking at this as a way to better engage our citizens in natural resources and also to be able to provide a platform for them to provide information to us so that we can better serve their needs. I think that it'd be kind of fun. We created this tree to show, it's my idea, to all the data the agency has. It's not readily available for the citizens of Minnesota. We have it on the web page. It's not all put together in a way that's easy for them to pull the information that they need. So what we want to be able to do is to have a really modern web platform that allows us to integrate the data, be able to do some website content management so that we can really deliver services to citizens in a way that gets them what they need. And so we did some examples of things that citizens might like trail condition reporting and some personalization and some other things that are on there. I think a good example is we built the Fall Colors webpage, and it's been really, really a popular thing. Last year at Lindbergh State Park, when the leaves were at the peak there, the park manager posted some photos, and all of a sudden he had 100, that Saturday he sold 153 daily permits and 50 annual permits. He doesn't see business like that on a regular basis, but I think this is the opportunity that's here for us to be able to really get citizens out and get them out to different places, and also, like I said earlier, so that we can hear from them more easily. So now imagine that we have a Fall Colors webpage, and you want to go grouse hunting, but now you want to know when the leaves are off the trees, right? Because shooting grouse with tree leaves on is not so much fun, not so easy. So now, all of a sudden, we have an application that's for grouse hunters, and it kind of builds off of the fall leaves page, also provides them information on where to hunt. Right now, we have where to hunt opportunities, but it's segregated by WMAs, forest lands, all these different things. We really need an application that will allow a grouse hunter to know, am I on public land? Is this an easement? Do I have the right to be here? Where can I go? Where are the roads? Where are the parking lots? Is the season open? Maybe even in the future, vegetation type is available. Where to get your license? So I think these are just some examples of opportunities that we could have. The one I'm most interested in is the snowmobile application, one that would have groomers report when they get off the trail and let you know that the trails are ready to ride. One where riders could let us know what they're experiencing on the trail. One where the GPS maps are readily available, information on parking's available, all kinds of stuff's available. So these are some of the opportunities we could have with this initiative.
You can continue on to the other change item.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members, we've got two additional change items left. The first one is legal support. This is requesting $1 million one time for the upcoming biennium that would allow the department to defend decisions on water management, environment, and other issues. Over the recent years, and we expect to continue, the agency would be involved in several large and complex lawsuits that will require litigation over the upcoming biennium. What we've seen in the past, costs can include expert witnesses, staff time, attorney general, court time, defense preparations. And when we have these cases, we don't have a specific funding source to fund the cost of these, and so the charges are charged back against individual program areas where these cases come from. And so with larger cases, it has become more difficult to identify the funds, to adequately defend them, and again, the costs will have been coming out of program funding. So the proposal would ask for just the upcoming biennium additional funding to support two additional legal positions, additional support from the AG's office, or to contract legal services. And it would allow DNR to retain advice from experts in the natural resources area while defending its natural resources decisions without imposing undue hardship to the program area's budgets.
Director Martinson, specifically, this is anticipation of a particular lawsuit? But that's a question.
Mr. Chairman, this is not necessarily an anticipation of a particular lawsuit. We've seen an increase in our Attorney General costs. I have some trend information here. Just let me.
No, that's okay.
You know. Okay, but we've been seeing an increase. I think White Bear Lake is an example. The Rogers, Lynn Rogers Bear case, we spent considerable agency resources working on those two, and we see other lawsuits coming to the agency over the next few years. This is not the agency pursuing litigation against others. This is to help us defend agency decisions.
Correct, but isn't there a strong possibility if precious metal mining moves forward on the Iron Range, the anticipation that there could be lawsuits from interest groups?
Mr. Chairman, I think that that is one potential outcome. I certainly think that there are many other agency decisions that could result in some additional costs.
Thank you. I have a couple questions. Representative Hornstein.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. You asked the question that was on my mind. I wanted to get some examples of what, you know, these lawsuits were. So I think that was covered.
Thank you. Representative Uglin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Martinson, right now with our with your legal problems and things, you are relying on the Attorney General. Did I understand that correctly?
Director Martinson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we are relying on the Attorney General. We also have hired one in-house general counsel position that is providing some legal advice to the commissioner, not representing us in the courts, but providing internal legal advice. And that position is helping us to save some money because she's able to do work at a lower rate, but it's not going to be enough, we feel, to cover future costs.
Representative Uglin.
So, Director Martinson. So you have you've done your due diligence on this and figured your in-house costs versus your outsourcing costs. My question is also, have you looked at obviously your when you bring this in-house, your legal support that's going to have to come along with it in terms of paralegal, actually the legal support from, for instance, some. Software like Westlaw and all those costs, have you looked at those?
Director Martinson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we have taken a look at some of those. We have been exploring sharing resources with the Pollution Control Agency regarding getting access to Westlaw, trying to reduce costs that way, and we're also trying to figure out what within this $500,000 legal support that we would need in terms of a legal secretary or some other support. That's what we're building into this proposal.
Representative Uglin, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Martinson, you know, my experience has been in many cases when you're outsourcing, you know, that's fine, and then when you no longer have the need, the tap turns off. But now you're building an internal legal system. And yes, there are probably some anticipated lawsuits and everything else. I can understand that. But what is your game plan for when the demand drops off for legal services? What will you do?
Director Martinson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we are planning to post these positions as unclassified positions. So we would be prepared to have them leave when the funding is no longer available. But we sincerely believe that by doing some due diligence on the upfront side, we can perhaps reduce future legal costs by giving good advice to the commissioner, good decisions made, and also supporting the Attorney General's office when we actually do get into litigation.
Ms. Julek.
Mr. Chair, Representative, and just this proposal is for one-time funding for the upcoming biennium.
One time. Thank you, Mr.
Representative Hackbarth.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and Director. That this gets to my question. How much is the ongoing amount for legal services within the DNR now? This is a $1 million over and above what you're already getting. It's just one time for this biennium. But what's the ongoing amount?
Ms. Julek.
Mr. Chair, excuse me, we currently budget around $865,000 annually spending has been above that in the recent years.
Thank you. That was my question, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I think you have one more change item.
Mr. Chair, our last change item is a operation adjustment request. The governor is requesting across state agencies a 1.8% operating adjustment for compensation-related activities for fiscal 16 and 17. This adjustment would offset any inflationary increases, such as annual step increases, health care, or employer costs for compensation. For the Department of Natural Resources specifically, this request is for direct appropriations only within the general fund, and then within the Game of Fish operating account only, and then certain natural resources accounts, including minerals management, ATV, off-highway motorcycle and off-road vehicle, snowmobile, and water rec. Again, where the accounts have funding available under the governor's budget. This also includes an allocation of shared services proportionally across the programs that are included in this request. The 1.8% was based on the Minnesota Management and Budget did an analysis of compensation increases per FTE over the last 10 years. The 1.8% was the average across those 10 years, so that's where that figure is coming from. And this proposal would allow the DNR to maintain its current level of services without having to increase vacancies to manage those types of inflationary costs.
Thank you. Director Martinson, I just have more. It's a couple things that are comments, if you could. One is a question. Does a volunteer magazine cost, or is it revenue neutral, or what's the status on volunteer magazine?
Mr. Chairman, the Conservation Volunteer Magazine is self-funded through donations.
And is it, how does the department net out on it? Director Martinson. If you could get back to us if you don't know, I'm just curious. I always thought it was a great magazine, and I know you may, that we make donations for it. My next question is related to your facilities. Can you get back to me on if it's cheaper to outsource things like oil changes? Are we maximizing that and minimizing our internal costs? And is that only an example of should we also be doing more outsourcing of brakes or major vehicle work and such? And then do you ever purchase extended warranties? I'm assuming you don't, but is that ever in the works, do you know? And if you could get back to that on that, I just would like to have a little better grasp on those costs. Any additional questions by members? Members, we're tomorrow going to have the MPCA for tomorrow and Thursday. We're adjourned.